President Donald Trump is inaugurated in Washington, D.C. this week. Father Francis Mann delivered the closing inaugural prayer. We'll talk to him. Academy Award-winning director Mel Gibson shares his thoughts on the L.A. fires that destroyed his home and how it might be preparing him for his next big project. Daily Wire personality Michael Knowles tells me how acting, the classics, and his faith fuels his work. A Canadian family abandons health care in that country to save their son in the United States. We'll tell you why. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. We have a great show for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Real Raymond Arroyo on Instagram or RaymondArroyo.com if you can't get enough. I have lots of cool content there. He is a retired priest of the Diocese of Brooklyn who began an unlikely friendship with President Donald Trump and this week delivered the closing benediction at his second inauguration.
We lift our hearts in gratitude for the beloved parents of President Trump. Without Mary and Fred Trump, this day would never be the miracle that has just begun. From their place in heaven, may they shield their son from all harm by their loving protection and give him the strength to guide our nation along the path that will make America great again.
Here to tell us about how he came to know the president and how it felt to deliver that closing prayer at the inauguration, I'm joined by Father Francis J. Mann. Father, thank you for being here. You made special mention of President Trump's parents at the end of the prayer. Tell us why and how it's connected to the way you really came to meet the president.
Yes, exactly. Well, a couple of years ago, after President Trump left the White House, I had discovered that his parents and his brother, his oldest brother, Fred, and his grandparents were interred in a cemetery around the corner from where I live. And I tried to find the gravesite on my own. It was very unsuccessful. And when I asked some of the cemetery employees, workers, where the grave was, even with my collar on, dressed as a priest, they completely misdirected me. Apparently, I guess they didn't want anybody, you know, going up near the gravesite for, you know, somebody might do something bad or improper. I really don't know. But a funeral director showed me that I know. And while he was there, he said to me, "Come on, Father, come on, hurry up, hurry up." I said, "Why are you rushing me?" He said, "I don't know, there may be cameras in the trees or something, somebody watching us." And you know, I said, "Oh, come on," you know. And so I left. And a few days later, I came back and I realized the first time I visited that it was not as it was a little bit unkempt, you know. The grass was a little overgrown, and I said, "Oh, let me go back home." And I brought a weed whacker and some really nice artificial plants and flowers to kind of redecorate the grave and to make it look really nice. And what I did is I sent a photo to Mar-a-Lago with my name. I mentioned I was a priest. I sent it to the director of Mar-a-Lago, and I said I was a priest, and here's my phone number, my address, and all that kind of stuff. And about a week later, I received a call about 8 o'clock in the evening. Huh. And it was, "Hey, Frank, Father Frank, this is your favorite president." And I said, "No, this is a joke. Who is this?" "Frank, it's me." I just laughed. I said, "This can't be you. This is..." Then I realized it was President Trump, you know. Uh-huh. And I said, "I have to sit down. I said, my legs are a little weak now, uh-huh. you know." I said, "I can't believe you called me." Yeah. And he asked me about what I was doing at the gravesite, why, how I found it and that kind of, you know.
Yeah.
And the conversation was really animated and very fascinating. And at one point he said, if you ever need me, you give me a call. Huh. Give me a call. Now, I want you to take down this number, but don't you tell anybody. Okay. And that's what happened.
And you continued in contact with him.
Yeah, I did. I did. In fact, I not long after that, I visited. He invited me to Trump Tower, and we spent some time there. It was a wonderful to see him in person for the very first time. Was like, oh my God! In fact, that was my when I was brought into the room, his office. I just stood there and went, oh God, I can't believe this. You know, it was like it was so overwhelming.
Were you surprised to be asked to deliver that final prayer at this historic second inauguration?
Well, to be blunt with you, I had on a few occasions when I met him at Bedminster in his, you know, in Jersey, I was there twice. I spent an overnight and even in Trump Tower, mm-hmm. I did ask him many times, you know, not tons of times, but a few. And I said, if you ever run for president again and get elected, can I do a prayer at your inauguration? And his response was basically the same. He would say, well, we'll find something. We'll find something. And, you know, I was very persistent. Mm. And I said, no, I don't want something. I want to say a prayer. But when I got the call from his assistant, like 2 weeks ago or so, I was like, wow. You know, it was very surreal. You know, meeting him in person three times was quite extraordinary. But to hear that I was invited to do that was completely mind-boggling to me. Yeah. It really was. It took me days to process it. Even now, I find it difficult to process.
Tell me what it was like being in the room at that moment. I mean, delivering this prayer at the end of this extraordinary inauguration. I mean, it's the first time it's been in the rotunda since 1985. You had cross currents of culture and politics. Maloney's there and the tech bros and Zuckerberg. It was an incredible gathering, a cross culture, if you will, of American society. Your thoughts of being there and closing out the entire inauguration?
It was overwhelming. I tell you, my anxiety level went through the roof. I wish I had a Valium at that point to calm me down, because I was really, the palms of my hand were sweating. I was really a wreck, to say the least. But I imagined myself being in like a church. It was like almost like being in a sacred environment, you know. It's like a church. It was like a church to me, like being in church, and that kind of calmed me down. But to look around and see all these congressmen and senators who I've seen in the news over the years, in the press, you know, to see the Clintons, Obama and Bush and Biden, it was really quite interesting.
Yeah.
And what was a little bit amusing to me is President Biden had he winked at me. And he nodded. He acknowledged my presence, and he looked at me and smiled, and he made the sign of the cross.
Well, old Catholic habits die hard, Father.
It was very funny.
Throughout Inauguration Day, there were numerous mentions of God and prayer by the presidents, by others, particularly by President Trump. How have those attempts on his life last year, do you think, changed the man that you knew? And what are your hopes for the next 4 years? What advice did you give the president?
I found him to be a calmer person, a more mellow, you know, not as, I don't know what the word would be, you know, hot-headed or whatever the word may be. He was much, much mellower. And I think there's no doubt that God is, the mention of God or the presence of God in his life is very significant. You know, he's mentioned it many times in speeches and rallies, even before the assassination. As you could see or could hear, at the end of my prayer, I wanted to quote his very famous line that we are Americans and Americans kneel to God and to God alone.
and Americans kneel to God and to God alone. Amen.
And I truly believe that he feels that to be so in his heart, you know. And I've said to him many times, you know, when I go to the gravesite of your mom and dad and your brother, I don't just go there to plant flowers. I spend time there to pray to your parents that they will intercede for you and bring you a deepening of your faith, strengthening you, and to protect you and watch over you. And I've told him that on multiple occasions. And, you know, I think he found that very comforting.
Father, before I let you go, did he ever visit the gravesite with you?
Not with me. But one time he did call me and he said, Father Frank, guess where I am? I said, I have no idea. He said, I'm in the cemetery. I said, you're in the cemetery now? He said, why didn't you call me? I mean, I'm right around the corner. He says, oh, I don't want to bother you right now. I don't want to bother you right now. But he thought I was busy, which I wasn't at the time. Yeah. But he was in the cemetery with he was with Eric, his son. And Eric got on the phone and he said to me, Father, this is so beautiful. These flowers and, you know, the decorations, what you've done, it means a lot to my dad and to my family. And I found that to be very touching. But I've never been in a cemetery with him, actually.
Yeah. Well, Father Frank Mann, I thank you for your time and, of course, for the beautiful prayer for the entire nation at this historic moment. What a gift, you know, for you, for all of us. It was sort of incredible watching you there.
It was a great honor. An indescribable honor.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for the time, Father, and pray for us. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
I sat down with Mel Gibson 20 years ago, can hardly believe it, on the set of The Passion of the Christ and conducted one of the first interviews about that important and landmark film. But when these terrible fires struck Los Angeles, he lost his home, and I wanted to see how he was doing. So I had him on my Arroyo Grande podcast last week, and the story made international headlines. Mel said The Lost was a preparation for his next big project. Watch. This week, you did an interview, and you said, in passing, you see this loss of your home as a purification. How so?
Well, it was an odd mixture of sadness and kind of a weird realization and blessing, I think, because I thought, you know, they're just things. I mean, yeah, I'm going to miss some stuff. There was valuable stuff. There was personal stuff that just breaks my heart, you know. But, I feel like I'm being stripped down and prepared for something else. Now, that's maybe very personal, but I feel like the Almighty's preparing me to do something big.
Well, I have to say, when I heard that, I thought, I wonder if this is, or if you're regarding this as a spiritual preparation for the resurrection movie you're about to embark on.
Yeah, I think that's kind of it. It's like, hey, look, God gives, God takes. We come in with nothing. That's the same way we go out, you know. And here's the deal. You'll always be okay.
Mel Gibson's new film, Flight Risk, opens this weekend in theaters everywhere. And you can see the entire interview at the Arroyo Grande YouTube page or wherever you get your podcasts. RaymondArroyo.com has all the links. He's a former actor, Yale grad, political commentator, Daily Wire host, and cigar aficionado. He's become one of the most popular young conservative voices in the media landscape today. He's also a devoted traditional Catholic. I recently sat down in Nashville with Michael Knowles to discuss how his origins and his faith influence his work. Here's my interview with Michael Knowles. At 7 years old, you start in the drawn to the theater.
Yes.
Why?
To my great shame, though I think you can empathize with me.
I completely empathize. Yes.
My whole life, I knew that I wanted to be in politics and in show business. I don't know how. Before even my earliest memories, that's just what I wanted.
Did you go to the theater as a kid? Somebody take you?
I did. I would go. I grew up in New York, yeah. So I would go see Broadway or different, you know, shows, regional, and I really enjoyed it. But both of those things were in my head from an early age. In fact, I knew since I was a little kid I wanted to go to Yale because I felt Yale was the only place you could go and be in politics or in show business.
Or in the arts.
You know, in the arts. It did both. And so I was always quite drawn to that. And I think many people will hear that and say, well, okay, politicians and actors have a lot in common. They're liars. They're egotistical. They're very vain.
But they shouldn't.
But they shouldn't because at their best, acting is not lying. It's telling the truth in imaginary circumstances.
Yes.
And at their best, actors and politicians care about people. They care about character. They care about what makes human beings tick. They care about human nature.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're bad versions of both of those things. But at their best, I think they have a lot in common, which is why you see a lot of Ronald Reagan's, Arnold Schwarzenegger's, Donald Trump's, for that matter.
Yeah, yes. Well, the showbiz is a part of connecting with people. And if you use it for good,
yes,
there's a power there. Tell me about, I saw in your biography, the Stella Adler Conservatory, where you studied as a very young person.
Yes, I was an early teenager, and I studied there. But Stella Adler was gone at this point.
Yes, yeah.
And I believe you studied with the woman herself.
Yeah, my old mentor, and torturer. Yeah,
yes.
For 3 years, I was in her last class. I think I'm the reason she had the last class, but we definitely put her away. She was a great, I mean, for those who don't, Stella Adler was kind of one of the apostles of acting technique in America.
Yes.
And look, the time I was studying in New York, Michael, it was at amazing. I studied, you're going to really be envious of this. I studied personally with Sandy Meisner, Uta Hagen, Stella Adler. Beatrice Straight was a dear friend of mine who did network, won an Academy Award for network, and taught the Chekhov technique. So to be there at that moment and see, I mean, I really did feel like a disciple to these people.
It's unbelievable because my teacher, after the Stella Adler School, she was gone. I went back for a professional scene study with Win Handman, he was an assistant to Meisner in the 50s. And what's funny about all these people you're naming, though, the members of the group theater, Win later, they were all basically commies or socialists.
At one point. Stella left, but some stayed for a long time.
Yes, and I thought it's very funny to be a conservative, but to have been trained by these people, you know, disciples of Shaw and all of these radical left people. But I think of that training in many ways as being similar to going to a very left-wing university, which is if you can maintain your beliefs, your core of beliefs, it's really very helpful because it exposes you. There is not a left-wing thought that has not been presented to me, that I haven't had to consider. That's just the mainstream of the culture. And so if you can swim against the tide a little bit, you get all of the benefits of their teaching, and you also can figure out where they go a little wrong.
So Stella kind of left, I think, also the ideology behind. She was very committed to faith at the end of her life when I met her, and believed that was important for an actor to have.
And I always felt it was very helpful to have the Stella Adler technique as my bedrock because of what you say. It was much more about the imagination. It was much more about elevating yourself up to the character. She had this great line with her theatricality and histrionic way where she said, "There is nothing about getting dumped at prom that will help you to play the Prince of Denmark unless you are Danish royalty. You have to use your imagination."
Yep.
And this really, if you want to take it all the way to how we live our lives, to the moral life, this is kind of how it works. You know, with the Strasbourg view, you just keep digging into yourself. It's all me, me, me. But the Adler view, if I hope I'm not being too... I'm not reaching too much here.
No, you're not.
Strikes me as more Aristotelian, that actually the character comes out of the habit, that virtue is a matter of habit, actually. And
you're a servant to the text. She always said, you are here to serve the play. The play is not here to bend to you and your petty ways.
Precisely.
She's so right.
Precisely.
She was so right. Then you go off to Yale. You study history, Michael. What happened to the theater? Now, I know you continue doing...
Lots of plays
You were directing plays and operas.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I mean,
I was very involved, but I was. They didn't have a performance major.
Uh-huh.
Had they had a performance, you know, the graduate school had the Yale School of Drama has the performance. But undergraduate is basically a dramaturgy degree, and I didn't want that. However, I studied history and Italian literature was my double major, and my two dissertations both involved the theater. My history dissertation was about Lloyd Richards and August Wilson, because they were both at Yale at the same time, and August Wilson had his cycle of Ma Rainey and all that.
Yeah,
Fences just became a movie with Denzel Washington, another Win Hanman student. He's had a better acting career than I have after Win Hanman.
It's all right,
studio.
You have time. That's He's right. almost out. He's playing Gladiator at this point. It's,
right.
it's almost over.
So we had his, and then my Italian double major. The Yale department had found a play that was written by Machiavelli. People think of Machiavelli for the prince, political philosopher. He also was a playwright.
Yes.
And he wrote a famous play called The Mandrake, another one called Laclitia.
Yeah.
But there's a lesser-known one called The Girl from Andros, Landria. And it was actually an adaptation of a play by Terence, the Latin playwright, which itself was a translation of Menander's version, but we don't have that.
That's and it had never been translated into anything but Italian?
Not for the stage. There had been some kind of literary version for English, but it was not popular. So I was able to do the first ever stage translation into English of this play. And that's how they induced me to write a thesis, is they said, well, you can do this translation, we'll give you money to put it up, and it'll be a kind of fun experience. So even though I didn't major in the theater, my two majors did both tie directly back to it.
Hmm.
And even that, you think of Machiavelli, it involved show business, also very
politics.
Much politics.
Yeah. And then how does politics come in? So you graduate, you're working as an actor a little bit, and then there's a congresswoman in 2010.
The great Nan Hayworth.
The great Nan Hayworth. Yeah. And you become her spokesman? What happened there?
Yes. So I had known Nan as a family friend since I was a kid. And Nan was running for Congress, actually while I was still in college. And something about Yale that you might have picked up from this is you do everything but study there. So you do all sorts of extracurriculars, probably a little too much partying, and all these extracurricular activities. So I jumped on Nan's campaign. I started out as an intern, but on a congressional campaign, those campaigns are infamously short on cash, short on staff. It's a great political training ground because you get on-the-ground kind of nitty-gritty politics, but the issues are all federal issues, so you get national exposure. And if you have any ambition, you can rise up a campaign quickly.
Yeah.
So I took on a more prominent role in the campaign. We were running against a guy named John Hall, who was an incumbent. He was in the band Orleans. So one of their famous songs was "Dance with Me, I Want to Be Your Partner, Can't You See?" So we did a version, the Young Voters, for an Orleans reunion tour. And that was Vote With Me, Let's Make John Hall Leave Washington, D.C. And it got a little play, mostly because they threatened to sue us. So after that, Nan won, happily. After that, I was brought into a number of other campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked it. So when I was a jobbing actor in New York, doing a little bit of theater, a little bit of TV, a little bit of film, my day job, most day jobs for working actors are catering,
waiting
tables. Mine was working Republican campaigns. Which led to one of the craziest experiences. I auditioned for a role in New York, and they said, do you speak any other languages? And I said, well, I have Italian, touch of French. And I joked. I said, oh, and I have Esperanto. I'd studied it a little bit in high school. And I said, that probably won't be very useful. And they said, no, actually, it will. The other casting director says, will it? I says, yes, client number one speaks Esperanto. I said, your client's George Soros. She said, he is. How'd you know that? I said, because there are about five people on earth who speak Esperanto, and he's the biggest one.
Wow.
He's the only one with the money to cast something. They were casting actors to play sommelier and caterers at his wedding, his third wedding. And they cast me.
Oh.
And I said, this is the craziest thing. I've worked Republican campaigns at this point for years. There were people there, you know, Nancy Pelosi, Samantha Power, Bono was there, all these big liberal figures. And it actually gave me some comfort. Because I said, the fact that they hired me to do this job, they could have Googled me. Yes. I said, perhaps George Soros doesn't actually control the whole world.
In the way we imagine.
That's
right. It's a little more limited, just the Upper West Side.
Exactly.
It's okay, but it's good real estate.
Yes.
It's amazing. So you go, tell me about this, though. I'm going to fast forward a little bit here.
Yeah.
Andrew Klavan has a show.
Yeah. Even before he had a show.
Before you were friends with his son, or worked with his son, Spencer, right?
Yes, I was in college. I directed him in opera. We lived in the same dorm.
Is that how you met Andrew?
Yes, and I was a fan of Andrew, and I knew Spencer. I was friends with Spencer.
Yeah.
And somehow I didn't put the two together. Plavin's not a very popular last name, yeah, but I didn't put it together. He calls me up one day. He says, Michael, my father wants a little help with his communications. Could you help out? You're the only guy I know in conservative politics and show business. I said, sure, okay. And so we met and became fast friends. Mm. And it's all kind of providential, I guess. I was planning to move to L.A., do more film work or TV work. Drew was moving down from Santa Barbara to L.A. We were going to move there around the same time. So I was working with him. That was another one of my day jobs. In fact, I was I had to write like him. I had to learn to write like him for, you know, social media and things like that. And so we end up there. There was a group out there at the time called the Friends of Abe, a secret society, so secret it had a Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
You know, very
and regular postings in the L.A. Times.
Exactly.
But yes.
Yeah. So I was part of that group, you know, conservatives in show business. And the head of the group at the time was Jeremy Boring. They were putting together first a group called Truth Social, which became The Daily Wire. And I was banging around there. But when Jeremy asked me to join The Daily Wire, I was going to be the pizza boy number three or something of The Daily Wire. There were five employees. He said, do you want the job? And so I said, okay, that's fine. We do it. The election day, 2016, I was rapping. It was the last day of principal photography on a very low-budget movie, but that one that I had the lead role in. And I really felt like the dog that caught the car. You know, here, this is great. I'm in L.A. I get to make this movie, albeit with a low budget. And I drove back to the Daily Wire. We did election coverage that night. And I did find something odd, which was when I was on set, when I was actually on the happy occasions I was working as an actor, I was thinking about, boy, wouldn't it be fun to be at the Daily Wire in politics? I was thinking about my day job. So that's very odd. And we go there. The Daily Wire at that point was so small, but it was gaining a lot of steam. Hmm. Trump wins, and I publish a joke book called Reasons to Vote for Democrats, a comprehensive
New York Times best-selling joke book, number one.
A number one national best-selling joke book, but I have to correct you, Raymond.
Yes.
The fake news New York Times would not give me my listing. They did not consider my book to be a real book.
Oh, well.
Now, and they might have had a point, actually, on that one.
It missed a few words, but other than words, it was a book.
And it had a great epigraph from Thucydides at the beginning. So this is not a work to win the applause of the moment, but a contribution for all time.
Tell people the title of the book.
Reasons to Vote for Democrats, of course.
And the internals of the book are?
Totally blank. Totally blank. And so the Times had a point on that, I guess. But we just launched Daily Wire, and we put it out there, and this thing is jumping up the charts. Mm. It's number 20 on all of Amazon. Mm. Number 10, number 5. Fox News calls, asks me to go on the morning show on Fox and Friends. I said, okay, that's kind of a funny bit. I go on, and by the end of the hit, it's number one in the country. Mm. Major publishers get into a bidding war for the rights to nothing. They wanted to buy the rights from me to nothing. I sold it to them. So, Jeremy insisted I make them pay a lot of money because it was only funny if they paid a lot of money.
Yeah, that's right, for nothing.
Yes, exactly. And then, but they killed the publicity on it because they didn't want me to make fun of them for paying a lot of money for nothing. They didn't get the joke, you know. So Fox invites me back on. They want to get it back up there. And I said, well, I've already done the joke about the blank book, so we got to do something else. And I don't know, they interviewed me about Trump's Syria policy or something. So I said, well, look, I'm relieved to have a good president who has a coherent foreign policy now. What do you know? President Covfefe, the great man himself, was watching his favorite morning show. He sees this, and he tweets out an endorsement, a great book for your reading enjoyment, you know, Reasons to Vote for Democrats by Michael Knowles. Jumps right back up to the top of the charts, and then the Daily Wire gives me a show. I think I'm the only show host in history who got his show for not writing a book.
How did that transition work for you? I mean, because it's one thing to work on other people's shows. It's one thing to be a guest on a show. When you're carrying the freight, it's hard.
I was really pleased, in retrospect,
that
I did not get my show until I was 27? So I was still pretty young.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm glad I didn't get a show at 22. I'm really glad I didn't get a show at 18. A lot of kids these days, because the barrier to entry is even lower than it was when I started.
Yeah. What role does faith play in all this? I know you fell away from your faith for a time.
Yeah.
We all have that experience. What brought you back?
I fell away at 13. I fell away at my confirmation.
Oh.
This was 2003. So this was the church scandals, the new atheists, you know, Christopher Hitchens and all those seducers who were Sam Harris and them.
Yeah.
They were their message was perfectly tailored for a punk 13-year-old boy who thought he was smarter than he was.
Right, with somebody who's smart and read. If you read, they're convincing on the page.
They're convincing. They're good prose writers. Mm-hmm. But they're probably not as convincing for a 23-year-old who reads, or a 33-year-old, but for a 13-year-old, yeah. They got him. And so I had just the right amount of hubris. There was scandal in the church. Mm-hmm. I had some wonderful catechism teachers personally, but catechesis broadly in the 1990s was very, very weak. And I would say the reforms that followed the Second Vatican Council did not achieve liturgically, I think, what they were trying
you
to
think?
Achieve.
You think? You know, I'm trying to be diplomatic.
Liturgically? How about seminarians, yeah. Baptisms, marriages, confirmations, confession? I could go on.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
It's and all so kind of a nosedive.
I remember when I was convinced that God exists because a friend of mine who was cradle Catholic, grew up megachurch Protestant, fell away from the faith around the same time I did. Now he's reverted to the Catholic Church. He and I kind of did it together.
Many years ago, my wife was not Catholic and had bad, she's had a lot, heard, read and absorbed all the propaganda about the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Whore Babylon.
Right.
Yeah, worship saints and plaster saints and they're crazy people and why Mary, all of that. And I took her to Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, where Cardinal O'Connor at the time was holding forth, and he was impressive. And the power of his faith and his oratory cut through, but it didn't seal the deal. It wasn't until I took her to the Latin Mass in Washington, D.C., Old St. Mary's, which no longer has the Latin Mass.
As I recently learned this past weekend, in fact, when I tried to go.
Oh, yeah. It's gone.
Yeah.
And this was a bastion. In fact, the Mass never stopped there, but it stopped now. Why, before we talk about that, which I do want to talk about, what is it, do you think, drawing young people to the Latin Mass at a time when Rome seems determined to stamp it out?
It should not be surprising that the Mass, which formed statistically all of the saints ever, just about, would have some pull on people. It is a beautiful liturgy. And in the deformations that followed, perhaps for good intentions, but that followed the Second Vatican Council, so much beauty was ripped away for really weak reasoning. You know, the iconoclasm that destroyed so many churches after the council, after the reforms that followed the council, because we have to distinguish between the council and the
reforms.
Right,
and what happened
afterwards. Yes. I'm 18 or 19, I'm in Italy for a summer abroad. And I said, well, look, I'm not faithful anymore, but I'll go to the Vatican. I want to see a Latin Mass. Or I want to see a Mass.
A Mass.
This is after the motu proprio from Pope Benedict XVI. And the Latin Mass kicks in. And I had never experienced anything like this before.
Oh, you'd never been before?
No, I didn't know what it was.
Wow.
I knew the church used to speak in Latin in the old-timey days.
Yeah.
That's all I knew.
Yeah.
I went up. I was not in a state of grace. It didn't even occur to me to go to confession. Mm. I went up to receive our Lord in the Eucharist. And I'm standing there with my hands. I was taught in catechism.
Yeah, this is the way they taught. This is how you do receive, yeah.
And whoever, it was a man with a red hat, so it was a pretty serious fellow there who was
cardinal.
He was a cardinal who was mm-hmm. who was administering the Holy Communion. Mm-hmm. And he didn't move. Waiting. I said, am I doing something? It's been a while, I guess. Yeah. And I went to ask him what I was doing wrong. And he placed the Eucharist on my tongue. So, okay. And so I said, wow, that was odd. I wonder why. Oh, okay. Uh-huh. I put it out of my head. At this point, though, you can find the traditional Latin Mass. I noticed it in New York, here and there. And even in the Novus Ordo, you know, wonderful, my old parish, Church of St. Michael in New York, there was a wonderful, very reverent
Novus Ordo.
Novus Ordo.
With Latin,
lot of
the
Latin.
Way it was envisioned, correct. The way the council envisioned it.
Yes.
It wasn't to stamp out Latin or remove the chant.
Yes.
It was to bring a little more vernacular into the Mass.
Right. Which
became a runaway train.
Why are the young people drawn to the traditional Latin Mass? Because we want truth. We've grown up in an age in which we were taught from diapers that there is no truth. Or if there is a truth, we can't really know anything about it.
I am always amazed when I travel, no matter where I travel. The Latin Mass, it's never in the glitziest, big, beautiful, you know, places.
No.
It's in little chapels. Now it's, of course, it's practically underground.
Yes.
It's practically underground. But packed with people and screaming babies and women and their children. It's a beautiful sight. It's the future of the church. It's the family.
It is the future of the church. It literally is.
Yeah.
In my traditional Latin Mass parish, the median age is about 8. Yeah. because of all the kids.
I've been to that parish. I know.
It's a small, you know, people crawling over each other practically. Even if you took the kids out, though, probably the median age would be about 30.
Yeah, very young.
Maybe. You know, it's, yeah. And so I find I travel a lot. And I will go to Novus Ordo Masses when I travel sometimes. And I can't help but notice that the median age in those Masses is about 102.
Yeah.
And the median age in the traditional Latin Mass, the supposedly stodgy Mass pushing the youth away, is much, much younger. And so it's above my pay grade, of course, to question the cardinals or the bishops. But when I hear bishops inveigh against the traditional liturgy or discourage even reverent practices in the liturgy because they want to bring the youth back into the pews, I think, you know, I actually have a little bit of experience as a youth, and it would seem to me that if you really wanted to bring some aggiornamento to the church in the spirit of accompaniment, in the spirit even of synodality, perhaps, perhaps we ought to listen to what the laity want, and what the laity want is tradition and reverence and beauty.
In their determination to stamp out, stop, outlaw, ban what is a beautiful, holy expression of worship of God. Why would you ever want to stop that?
Well, there's something fitting about the traditional liturgies being driven underground by these very bishops. You know, I think of Henry VIII. When he goes in, destroys Canterbury Cathedral, tears down such beautiful icons, steals all the land. So the Protestants got all the good churches, and the Catholics went underground.
Yeah.
And the deformations that occurred to the liturgy after the Second Vatican Council, in many ways, the purpose was to make the Mass more Protestant, and that was supposed to bring people into the church, even though it didn't work. Yeah. And so once again, we have these Protestant rites, or seemingly Protestant rites, cropping up, and once again, the Mass of the Ages is driven underground. But it is in that struggle, it is in that oppression, to use a popular word, that often the church flourishes. You know, this is why we say, and the cardinals know this well, they wear the colored slippers, that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church.
Let's talk culturally about this political moment. I want to bring all this together, because the faith is bound up in this. Trump's victory, I don't see that as an isolated political victory. It feels like that was also a cultural shift rather than a party winning. Something is happening. What do you think is happening there? What is that a manifestation of?
Certainly you're right that this is a major cultural movement. You just look even at the demographics who shifted over this cycle. 46% of Hispanics, that's a shocking number. Mm-hmm. 1 in 5 black men. Republicans hadn't seen anything like that in a long time. 40% of women under the age of 30. This is the group of people supposedly most likely to vote for Kamala. 40% voted for Trump.
Yeah.
Some major, major movement has happened. This is a reaction to kitchen table issues. Inflation is really bad. Mm-hmm. Immigration is not only leads to criminality, but it's just deeply offensive that we're told we're not allowed to enforce the most basic aspects of our law. A nation without a border isn't a nation. There's nothing that delineates it from other nations. So that's just deeply offensive to people. One issue has dominated discourse more than any other, and that is the transgender ideology. And the liberals are so confused about this. They say, why this minor, seemingly trivial issue? Why do you conservatives want to make this such a big deal? I say, first of all, I'm not the one who forced the women to use the bathroom with the men. I'm not the one. I was happy with the way things were. You're the innovators. You're the cultural revolutionaries. But why is this such a big deal? Because it's so offensive to our intelligence. Everyone knows that a man cannot really be a woman. Everyone knows at a deep level. To tell us that is to make us look like idiots, and to force us to accede to this ideology is to force us to lie. And people really don't want to be forced to lie. And to say that a man is really a woman, that a big husky fellow in a dress is really could use the bathroom with a little girl, that tells you that a party has lost the common sense. And if they don't possess the judgment to discern between man and woman, they probably don't possess the judgment for much of anything else.
This is a major, something is, the ground is shifting, and I'm not sure people are fully aware of what's happening and what's next.
Well, you have to look at what happened on Election Day, because it's not just that Trump won.
Yeah.
He won in a massive Electoral College landslide. He won the popular vote as a Republican for the first time in 20 years. He won huge numbers of people, demographics that he was told he could not win. This was not particularly close. This was an absolute cataclysm for the left. And so the unwise and imprudent leftists just double down. They say, well, everyone's racist and sexist. Oh, good luck. Campaign on that. Yeah. You're all evil. Vote for us.
Yeah.
But the wise leftists are just left confused and crestfallen because they say, huh, I guess we were just wrong. Most of the country rejected us. Perhaps there's an error in our thinking. And Trump really, I think, is a wonderful figure for this, in part because he's not particularly ideological.
Right.
There are right-wing ideologues just as there are left-wing ideologues. Mm-hmm. But Trump is not ideological. He is a gut politician. His gut is quite good. He's a politician who recognizes what Aristotle would say is the paramount political virtue, which is prudence. When he's asked questions about trade, when he's asked questions about immigration, when he's asked questions about transgender bathrooms, his answer is usually, well, I don't, what works? What worked before? Yeah. What had we been doing? What does the wisdom of the ages have to tell us? That's a good guiding principle. And so he was able to claim the middle ground. He was able to claim the central territory.
Yeah. What is the role of the Michael Knowles Show going forward in this time? How do you see it? Will it shift at all? Will it change at all?
It will not change, but it will become, I hope, more of what it is. I hope that it deepens. And part of that is, going back to our friend Aristotle, it's not enough to just understand the virtues. You have to live the virtues. And I think this applies in political philosophy as well.
Yeah.
We move in time and space.
And we need each other. And you need to be in rooms with it. That's why I came here, by the way, to interview you and didn't do it via satellite. I hate satellite
yes.
interviews. I do them because you have to, because of the nature of what we're in. I much prefer this. You can't get a feel for people through the screen. You
That's
know
right.
this. We're often confined to these screens. There is something, well, incarnational.
Yes.
It goes back to what we're talking about earlier. The Latin Mass has its own incarnational reality.
Yes.
I think we're deprived of that in everyday life, which is maybe another reason why that Mass is so powerful.
So much of the smells and bells were stripped away as unnecessary, superfluous. But they're not so. I guess to determine if something's superfluous, you have to ask, what are we doing? What, and so the Mass is the representation of the Holy Sacrifice. You know, this is the highest form of prayer. This is a peek into heaven. A mystical reading of the Book of the Apocalypse shows
yeah,
you what's happening.
There it is, in technicolor.
That's right. It's in three dimensions and in technicolor. Mm-hmm. And you even think about our kind of faith. Our faith is different from other religions because the Gospels are not poetry primarily. They're not philosophy primarily. They're journalism. They're a description of events that happened in real life. And our Lord gave to us not just some words on paper. He gave us a church led by real men who went out to all the corners of the world to make disciples of all nations. And that living body, mystical body of Christ, is with us today. It means we got to put our bodies into it. You know, this is why sacramentals are so helpful. This is why the sacraments are crucial. You know, our Lord comes into time and space. And so we need to recognize we live in time and space. This is why I like to do live events. Some of my friends and colleagues, they don't want to do as many live speeches and events. It's kind of a hassle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you want to be with your family and your kids.
And you get protests.
I get occasionally burned in effigy.
Well,
you know, goes at the territory.
Yeah.
But I love them because we're incarnate creatures. This is where you really reach people. Even, I have a little side project, which is my cigar company, Mayflower
yes.
Cigars. Part of it is I like cigars. I think the body is a temple. The temple needs incense.
And your cigar company... tell everybody what the name of the cigar company is
cigar
and
company.
Explain why.
The company is called Mayflower Cigars. This might raise some eyebrows. Yeah.
Mayflower from this Italian?
Yes, it doesn't make any sense. My father, the Knowles side, not the Italian mm-hmm. side, okay. the Knowles side, they go back to the Mayflower. We had six ancestors on the Mayflower. They were extremely Protestant and puritanical and are probably spinning in their graves that their descendant is a mackerel-snapping papist.
Well, I mean, everyone raised tobacco and they got, okay. you know, they built the country.
But I wanted something patriotic, something
yeah.
historical, but not just, you know, guns and flags and cowboy boot cigars.
Right,
you know, I
yeah.
wanted it to have a little more history, maybe a little bit more elevated. So the Mayflower is good.
Yeah.
Well, on the one hand, it's very aristocratic. On the other, these people were rascals and
yeah.
they were booted out of England, and half of them died in their first winter
yeah.
here, and it was a tough, hardy life.
Sturdy people.
Cigars are a great equalizer. You go to any cigar lounge, you are likely to find a CEO and a construction worker having a great conversation. I mean, it just brings so many people together. Now, the other little hint about this, which I'll let the Catholics in on, is the symbol is a triangle, which comes from the Mayflower II ship, but also, you know, it's got kind of Trinitarian symbolism. And then the flower, it could be a Mayflower. It could be a Jacobite rose. How subversive, you know, is the Catholic imagery here? I'll leave it to
we'll
you
leave
to
it
decide.
To interpretation. We'll do another show on decoding the flower.
Michael Dulles, always a pleasure.
Thank
Great
you so much.
You. Save me a cigar next time.
I certainly will.
You can find out more about Michael Knowles at michaeljknowles.com. He's a former politician, now an entrepreneur from Montreal, Canada. He's also the father of a nearly three-year-old son, Arthur, who last October suffered a near drowning. After Canadian doctors wrote off Arthur's chances of survival, Nicholas Titro says he had no choice but to take his son to the U.S. for proper treatment. Joining me now to share Arthur's story is his dad, Nicholas Titro. Nicholas, thanks for being here. On October 8th of last year, your son Arthur, then 2 and a half, nearly drowned in the pool, but was rescued and eventually taken to Montreal Children's Hospital for treatment. Now, the doctors did an MRI, according to the reportage I've seen, to assess the damage, and they deemed that his brain damage was not extreme. How did they come to that conclusion, and how did this happen?
Well, long story short, we rented a house, and in our lease, we had asked, it was a condition of the lease that the owner was a real estate lady, a lawyer, was supposed to fence the pool, the in-ground pool, which she never did, pretexting, I guess, that defending herself in court was cheaper than spending $20,000 or $30,000 to fence a pool. So, you know, we have six children. We're not perfect. In an obscure moment, a few minutes of not paying enough attention, our son unfortunately fell into the pool. Then he was rescued. I did the CPR, emptied his lungs. Basically, he was dead in my arms. All his eyes were black. His fingertips were black. His lungs were filled with water. It was a very cold day near the freezing temperature. And then he was resuscitated and brought from one hospital to a more specialized pediatric hospital for children, the famous or infamous Montreal Children. And basically, he was extremely sedated with about 300% to even 500% of the normal drug that an adult or a child of his weight would have in his body. And based upon they evaluated after 5 weeks that our son had no cognitive or mental ability because based on an MRI, but it was impossible to assess his physical condition because it was extremely, extremely over-drugged. And we have brought two undercover doctors to assess the quantity, the posology of drugs that he was administered. And it was impossible for anybody under such sedation to show any cognitive ability whatsoever.
Nicholas, was he on life support the entire time?
Well, the first day they put a breathing machine. He was on life support, but from day one, he was able to overbreed the machine, and then we suggested to do a tracheostomy to put a little tube here, because when a child or an adult has a lack of oxygen to the brain due to a heart attack or drowning, the cartilage of the throat becomes very floppy. Because there's a little capillary vessels, a very small quantity, so it takes many months for it to become more solid, and it ends up blocking the airway. We said, put the hole, reduce the amount of drugs, and then we'll see if he breathes on his own. They extubed him, but with such a heavy dose of drugs that, he was able to breathe on his own, but the cartilage that was super floppy was blocking the airway. They said, oh, no, he cannot breathe on his own. He'll never breathe on his own. He cannot gag. And after 5 weeks, they said, we're going to unplug him unilaterally, not leaving us with any option, any choice. The parents, we were put in front of this this very biased decision from an ethics and moral committee that are doctors from the same hospital with the same employer, the same paycheck. We're colleagues. And have you ever seen doctors go against other doctors in Canada? That's something that never happens. Hmm.
Now, Nicholas, you did some research while your son is the 5 weeks that he's in the hospital, and you asked the hospital to give him a certain type of treatment. What did they say? What was the treatment?
Well, we investigated, like any normal parents would do, mm-hmm. what are the best available post-drowning doctors in the world. And in fact, very little people know that the best post-drowning doctor in the world is actually an American from New Orleans, a world-famous doctor, Paul G. Harsh, that many rich people or anyone in the world that has the means sends their children to his clinic. And he has reversed post-drowning cerebral damages on numerous children, and he's a Louisiana State University professor. So he tried so hard to give some medical advice politely and in a non-arrogant way to to his medical colleagues, our doctors in Montreal, but they kept on saying no, no, no. They were refusing any advice from any American doctor, even as famous as Dr. Paul G. Harsh of New Orleans, like the world's best in drownings. They were refusing everything that we were suggesting from the American doctors.
Yeah, and Nicholas, it's this hyperbaric oxygen treatment that the doctor, what's his name? Dr. Harp?
Paul G. Harsh.
Harp, that he employs. But I have to read this statement. A spokesman from the Montreal Children's Hospital released what I consider a chilling statement about Arthur's case. I imagine this was in the midst of your asking these questions. And they said, when meaningful recovery of brain functions is deemed unlikely, shifting the focus to ensuring comfort and reducing suffering is recommended. Families are supported with options such as second opinions or transfers if desired. Now, Nicholas, did you experience resistance to transferring Arthur to another facility? And I guess government rights here, or the hospital's prerogative, trumps parental rights.
Well, we experienced huge amounts of resistance. This press release came out from the hospital after they've seen that our story became viral with more than 5 million views on social media. Mm-hmm. They were judge and jury, and they tried to bully us into submission, which failed because I ran 4 elections and I got help from powerful organizations within Canada and the U.S. And we kind of forced them to let us leave the hospital to go towards an American hospital. And they were refusing such simple things as of like giving 30% oxygen twice a day, 2 hours a day, which costs like $10 in a month. And when we took our American doctors, when we were able to force the hospital to transfer us to Ochsner Hospital in New Orleans metropolitan area, we had American doctors and military in the plane, and they used that 30% new Louisiana State University technique to give 30% oxygen twice a day to remove brainstorming or how do you call it? I forgot the term in French, dystonia in English, where the child who has brain damage cannot control his movements and with his arms and legs and looks like a banana by stretching his back. In 2 hours and 45 minutes of simply applying the Louisiana State University Paul Harsh technique of giving 30%, he landed in New Orleans with no more dystonia or brainstorming. They could have done that 7 weeks ago. All they did was drug our child beyond belief. They refused everything.
One of the things that surprised me is when you advocated for this treatment, the Canadian hospital suggested that you and your wife should consider organ harvesting. What was your reaction to that?
Well, in general, it's something right. It's the right thing to do. You know, I'm a good Christian. You always want to help other people. But when you feel that it becomes like a drug, not a drug, like a sect or a religion where all the employees are promoting it, and you should look at the videos of the head of the pediatric unit, Sam Shemi. He's promoting this a bit like in an overly exaggerated way. They did not force us to do this, but they certainly told us that they would unplug unilaterally our child with or without our consent on November 29th, and that he would never be able to breathe on his own, that he had no gagging reflex, and that he will have dystonia all his life or brainstorming. And he doesn't have any of those. After 3 weeks and a half in New Orleans, we could have went home, but because he's so severely sedated that the Ochsner Hospital are amazing in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. They're taking their time to wean him off of heavy, heavy, heavy doses of drugs. Mm. So that's what we're doing right now. But he's breathing on his own perfectly. He has no more brainstorming, and he gags perfectly. He's getting better every day that God brings.
That's amazing. Now, I was going to ask you his condition, but I'm glad he's, you know, bouncing back and that you found the right doctor to help you, which is so key. Nicholas, do you believe Canadian doctors were too quick to write off Arthur's chances of survival due to Canada's legalization of euthanasia? And what would you tell other parents in Canada or elsewhere facing similar situations?
I think that you're pinpointing the best questions ever. I think that so many children, unfortunately, in around four elections, and I'm saying this because we've been there, in 7 weeks, they had like eight children who died. Here in New Orleans at Ochsner Hospital in the same pediatric intensive care unit, but in the U.S., no one died in 4 weeks. I just feel that in Canada in general, because hospitals are public with public funds, the patients are like a burden. They're seen as a burden, as an expense, super negatively. Whereas in the U.S., there's hope, there's optimism, and the patients are seen as a source of income. Just this alone makes the entire difference. And I feel the American doctors are much more open-minded, not narrow-minded. I feel that in Canada, it's like a kind of a military hospital with, you know, like a pyramidical pyramid where the head of the department, you know, your numbers, its budget, and they're very narrow-minded. And there's tremendous peer pressure amongst doctors. When you work in a big organizations, they have difficulty trying to do something different and something new.
Well, it seems the system incentivizes the quick disbursement of the client, no matter which way they go.
100%.
And if you can't quickly cure them, well, then we have another option for them. And it's an unfair and, frankly, inhuman system. But, Nicholas, I'm so glad you're here. We will leave it there. We'll continue to pray for your son, Arthur. And thank you for sharing his story. Keep us posted, please, on his recovery.
Thank you for everything you do every day.
You're very kind. Thank you. God bless you. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.